All right, welcome back to the deep dive. Today, we're taking a legal deep dive, something I thought would be particularly interesting for you since you're a law student.
Definitely interesting.
Yeah, we've got these two Ohio cases, both called State v. Barnett, and we're going to really, you know, kind of go deep and see what we can pull out in terms of, you know, guilty pleas and the whole idea of procedural fairness, you know, how that plays out in Ohio.
Yeah, it's really fascinating, actually. We've got State v. Barnett from 1987 and then another one, same style, from 2020. It's like a before and after picture, right?
Yeah, how things have changed or maybe stayed the same.
Exactly. And they both grapple with how appeals courts in Ohio look at plea agreements. Because we all know there's this constant tension between wanting convictions to be final, you know, for the sake of the system, but also ensuring that everyone involved got a fair shake legally.
Right, right. So let's start with that 1987 case. It seems like a good jumping off point, right? I mean, you mentioned it set a precedent, kind of a benchmark for how we deal with claims of ineffective assistance of counsel when someone's already pleaded guilty.
Yeah, that's a big one.
So paint the picture for us. What were the facts of this case? What even brought it to the appeals court in the first place?
Okay, so picture this. December 1986, Charles T. Barnett gets arrested for aggravated robbery. He can't make bail, so he's stuck in jail. Then, in January 87, the grand jury indicts him. Two counts of aggravated robbery. Both counts had this added thing about a prior aggravated felony, and one count also had a firearm specification, which is, you know, never good.
So already it sounds like a complicated situation. What about his lawyer? Was he happy with his representation?
Not at all. He felt like his first lawyer wasn't preparing for trial.
And that's always a red flag.
Huge red flag. Yeah. I mean, if your lawyer isn't prepping, how are you going to get a fair defense? That's the whole point, right?
Absolutely.
So they appoint him a new lawyer, but this is April 8th, 1987, and the trial is set for April 14th. Talk about a time crunch.
6 days.
Yeah, 6 days. The new lawyer's like, whoa, there's no way I can get ready for this. We need more time.
What did they do?
They asked the court for a continuance. They wanted more time to get ready for trial and also to deal with Barnett's speedy trial rights, which are, you know, constitutionally protected.
Right, but I imagine the court wasn't just going to hand them a delay without some strings attached.
Exactly. The court said, sure, we'll give you a continuance, but only if Barnett waives his right to a speedy trial.
Which I'm guessing he wasn't too keen on doing.
Nope, not at all. He was in a tough spot. He's facing these serious charges. He doesn't feel like his lawyer has enough time. But he also doesn't want to give up a fundamental right. It's a classic catch-22.
So what happened? What did he decide to do?
Well, under all that pressure, the day before the trial, Barnett decides to waive his right to a jury trial and plead guilty.
To everything?
Not quite. He pleaded to one count of aggravated robbery with that prior felony spec. In exchange, they dropped the firearm spec and the other robbery count.
Okay, so a plea deal. Did it end there?
Not quite. Before sentencing, Barnett tries to withdraw his plea. He's not happy with how things went down.
Understandable.
But the trial court denied his request without even a full hearing to really understand his reasons. And then, boom, on April 20th, 1987, he's sentenced to 12 to 25 years.
Wow. So much happened in just a few months. What were the big legal questions that the appeals court had to tackle?
Two main ones. First, does pleading guilty mean you automatically can't later say your lawyer was ineffective? And second, did the trial court mess up by not giving Barnett a proper hearing on his request to withdraw his plea?
All right, so let's unpack that first issue. What did the court say about guilty pleas and ineffective assistance of counsel claims?
Judge Grady, who wrote the majority opinion, starts by saying a guilty plea is a big deal. It's not just admitting you did the things they say you did. It's saying, I'm guilty of this crime.
Right, taking responsibility for the offense itself.
Exactly. So because of that, Judge Grady says a guilty plea usually does waive those ineffective counsel claims unless, and this is a big unless, the plea wasn't knowing and voluntary.
Meaning the defendant didn't really get what they were doing or felt pressured into it?
Exactly. Like if the lawyer messed up so badly that the plea wasn't really a free choice.
Okay, that makes sense. What about the second issue, the plea withdrawal? What did Judge Grady say about that?
So he sets up this thing called the abuse of discretion standard. Basically, the appeals court won't overturn what the trial court did unless it was, like, totally unreasonable.
So giving the trial court some leeway.
Yeah, but then Judge Grady lays out all these things the trial court has to consider when someone wants to withdraw their plea. Did they have a competent lawyer? Did the plea hearing follow all the rules? Was the withdrawal hearing fair? Did the court really listen to the reasons for wanting to withdraw?
Seems thorough. Did he say anything particularly memorable about these motions to withdraw?
Oh, absolutely. He says, A motion made prior to sentencing should be freely allowed.
Freely allowed? Why so lenient?
His thinking is, at that point, the state hasn't really been harmed by someone changing their plea. The goal is still to make sure everything's fair. So he's saying trial courts should be really open to letting someone withdraw their plea before they're actually sentenced.
Ben and Barnett's case.
The appeals court said the trial court messed up. They were so focused on the fact that he pleaded guilty that they didn't really listen to his reasons for wanting to change his mind. You know, the whole thing being rushed, his issues with his lawyer, all that.
Makes sense. Now, we also have Judge Wolf's opinion in this case, a concurrence and dissent. What was he adding to the conversation?
Judge Wolf was on board with the outcome, letting Barnett withdraw his plea, but he wanted to highlight something about speedy trial rights. See, even though Barnett pleaded guilty, Judge Wolf said he might still have a case later on, like in a post-conviction appeal, if his lawyer mishandled the speedy trial issue before the plea.
Ah, so even though the plea was withdrawn, there might still be legal loose ends.
Potentially. And he pointed out something specific. The trial date seemed fine at first glance, but the records weren't clear about whether Barnett, being stuck in jail, was entitled to a better calculation for his speedy trial rights. It's called the 3-for-1 rule in Ohio.
So, a little more nuanced to the whole situation. Okay, for a listener who's learning about all this for the first time, what's the big takeaway from this 1987 Barnett case? What should they be walking away with?
I think there are a few key points. First, a guilty plea has huge consequences. You're giving up serious rights when you plead guilty. Second, that doesn't mean you can never say your lawyer was ineffective, especially if the lawyer's actions directly led to you pleading guilty when you shouldn't have. And, maybe most importantly, trial courts need to take those pre-sentencing motions to withdraw a plea seriously, like Judge Grady said, freely allowed. It's about ensuring fairness above all else.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, let's fast forward to the 2020 Barnett case. Different person, different set of facts. Can you catch us up on this one?
So this time, it's Ariel Barnett. She's accused of assaulting two intimate partners back in October 2018. Now, unlike the 1987 case, instead of a grand jury indictment, the charges came through something called a bill of information.
Bill of information. Just for clarity, what's that all about?
It's basically a way for the prosecutor to directly file charges without going through the grand jury. It happens a lot when the defendant agrees to it.
Okay, so it's like an alternative path.
Exactly. Yeah. Anyway, Ariel Barnett ends up taking a plea deal and gets convicted in July 2019.
So no big ineffective assistance of counsel claims this time around.
Right. This one's more about procedure, the steps leading up to the guilty plea.
Interesting. What were the specific issues raised on appeal?
Two main things. Mm-hmm. First, Barnett argued that the bill of information shouldn't have been filed before she waived her right to be indicted by a grand jury. They argued it was out of order.
A very specific procedural argument. And the second issue?
The second one was about the 24-hour waiting period. Ohio law says that after a bill of information is filed, there's a 24-hour pause before things can move forward. Barnett argued that her plea wasn't valid because they didn't get a specific oral waiver of that waiting period on the record.
So again, very focused on the precise steps taken.
Yeah.
What did the appeals court say about all this?
Well, they weren't buying either argument. On the first one, about the timing of the bill of information and the waiver, they said there's no rule saying the waiver has to be filed first. And in this case, both documents were filed the same day anyway.
Case closed.
Pretty much. Plus, Barnett couldn't show she was actually harmed by the order of things. The court basically saw it as a technicality that didn't affect the fairness of the process.
Okay, and what about that second argument about the 24-hour waiting period?
On that one, the court pointed out that Barnett did sign a written waiver of the waiting period, which is allowed under Ohio law. They said that written waiver was enough, no need for a separate oral waiver during the plea hearing itself.
So paperwork matters.
Paperwork really matters. If you've got a valid written waiver, you're usually good to go.
It sounds like this 2020 Barnett case sends a different message compared to that 1987 decision. Would you say that's accurate?
I think so. The big lesson from the 2020 case is that appeals courts really care about whether someone was actually hurt by a procedural error, not just whether a rule was technically broken. It's about substantial justice, not getting hung up on minor things that don't really affect the outcome.
So a shift in emphasis, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But if we look at these two cases together, what do they tell us about guilty pleas in Ohio? What's the bigger picture?
I think what's fascinating is that contrast. The 1987 case is all about fairness. Did the defendant have good legal help? And was the plea truly their choice? The 2020 case is more about procedure, were the right steps followed, and was there any real harm done if they weren't?
So two sides of the same coin, maybe?
Exactly. Both sides are important. They reflect this constant balancing act that courts have to do. Guilty pleas are efficient, but we also have to make sure people's rights are protected. These two cases show that tension in action.
And for our listener, the aspiring lawyer, what should they be taking away from this comparison?
A few things come to mind. First, know Ohio Criminal Rule 11 inside and out. It's the rule book for guilty pleas, literally. Second, document everything, especially waivers. Get them in writing, signed, and dated. Third, even though the 2020 case suggests that courts aren't going to overturn convictions just because of minor procedural hiccups, the 1987 case shows that core fairness issues, like bad lawyering, can still be a big deal. And finally, those pre-sentencing motions to withdraw a plea, they deserve real attention from trial courts. The abuse of discretion standard isn't a rubber stamp.
Okay, some really good advice there. You've given us a lot to think about. Before we wrap up, any final thoughts, any big questions our listeners should be asking themselves as they continue their legal journey?
Yeah, I think what's really interesting is how these two approaches, focusing on fairness versus focusing on procedure, actually play out in the real world of plea bargaining.
Yeah.
Do these two cases taken together tell us anything about the power dynamics in the courtroom, you know, between the prosecution and the defense? It's something worth thinking about.
Absolutely. It's a reminder that legal principles are one thing, but how they work in practice is a whole other story.
Exactly.
All right. Great deep dive, as always. Really appreciate the insights.
My pleasure.
And for our listeners, thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive. We'll catch you next time.